I think more and more, our phones, our devices are absolutely capable of processing video and being able to edit them on the devices. So why not? And then, you know, we can do it on the go. A lot of people are travelers and making these videos and you know, no one wants to wait until they get home and onto their laptop. You want to just do it right there on the spot. And so I think it's great. And I'm really excited that more and more apps are allowing you to do much more robust video creation with just your devices.
Thanks for tuning into BeyondPodcasting.com, where we recognize that your online radio show is much more than just a podcast.
Your show can be broadcast live, which is not a podcast. Your show can be heard on a website, which isn't a podcast either.
Of course, your online radio show can and should also be syndicated as a podcast via RSS, where your listeners can subscribe using a standard podcatcher or your show's own branded app for Android and iOS.
BeyondPodcasting.com covers microphones, interfaces, mixers, production software, recording techniques, best practices, and more. Now enjoy another episode of BeyondPodcasting.com with your host, Alan Tepper.
Welcome to Beyond Podcasting. This is Alan Tepper, and I'm joined today by Cielo de la Paz, award-winning photographer, multimediographer expert, and founder of The Storyographist. How are you today, Cielo?
I'm doing great.
Glad to hear it. Welcome to Beyond Podcasting. We're here to talk about lots of things today, including you and your career and Project Rush from Adobe, which I published a first look article, and related things. So I think we're all excited to talk about Project Rush and how it compares with its closest competitor, which is LumaFusion, right, Cielo?
Yes, I am really, really excited to talk about it. It's been great discovering what this new app is going to be.
It seems to me that it has some different strengths and weaknesses compared to LumaFusion. What do you think?
I agree. There are pros and cons to this app. And again, I guess we'll see eventually what it ends up being. But right now, it promises to be something pretty amazing. It seems to be the all-in-one solution.
Yes, because to my knowledge, at least the current version of LumaFusion doesn't include a camera app, or does it? I can't remember. I think in the past it did, but I don't know if it does currently. Do you know?
Yeah, it does not currently have that capability. So LumaFusion is purely for editing.
I think maybe in one of its prior incarnations, it might have had it, but it was very simple. And I just discovered, even though I attended the press conference, I don't believe them mentioning that. And yesterday, I had the opportunity to see an interview that Dave Basulto of The Audiographer, which is a device similar to the Podcaster, which is a device that can hold devices, whether it's a tablet or a phone, and connect some physical accessories to it. He interviewed someone from Adobe, and at that point, I became aware that there is a capture, in other words, a camera app built in. And I wasn't aware of that before. And they did mention that it has some of the main features that we would normally find in an app like Filmic Pro or Movie Pro
or
on Android Cinema FV5, like locking the focus and locking the frame rate. But of course, there are other features in Filmic Pro that I don't know if they are included there.
Yeah, I'm curious too. So I went on their blog and they mentioned the capability of shooting, but they didn't really go into a whole lot of detail. So I was really excited to see that particular interview. And I did see that, yes, it can do some of the things that Filmic Pro can do, but you know, they didn't go into detail. And so other things
they mentioned locking focus and setting the frame rate.
Yeah, that was about it. And obviously,
exactly.
Filmic Pro can do other things, like you can shoot in log mode, like you can do rack focus, you can do all sorts of other things. And again, we don't know how robust Project Rush is going to be when it comes to shooting.
But the good thing, of course, is that if you want to shoot with a program like Filmic Pro or Movie Pro, you certainly could. And then you could edit it with Project Rush if you wanted to.
Right. That's kind of how I see myself definitely using this app. I don't know if I'm going to be using it to shoot because I highly doubt that it'll be compatible with a lot of the hardware out there, especially the DJI Osmo, which is a gimbal. So I know Filmic Pro is really compatible with that. You can control Filmic Pro using the gimbal. And I'm not sure if Adobe Project Rush is going to go that far out. So the way I see myself using this is purely just for editing.
BeyondPodcasting.com.
This episode of Beyond Podcasting is brought to us in part by Descript, the transcription, text, audio, caption, subtitle editor, which automatically transcribes your audio into text, allows you to correct that auto transcription, edit the text, and have the audio reflect the corresponding changes instantly. Descript is now available for Mac, Windows, and even a web version for Chromebooks. As a special bonus for Beyond Podcasting listeners, for a limited time, you'll get your first 100 minutes of auto transcription free by visiting descript.beyondpodcasting.com. That's a special link, and Descript is spelled D-E-S-C-R-I-P-T. Get your first 100 minutes free by visiting descript.beyondpodcasting.com.
Beyondpodcasting.com.
Yes, and another thing that's still not clear is whether Project Rush will be able to accept files that are in RAW modes, like you mentioned. That's still not clear whether LumaFusion already does, correct?
Yes, LumaFusion is great. So for example, even when I'm editing on my desktop, some of the files that I try to bring in, Premiere Pro has a hard time. I have to do some fancy configuration. But with LumaFusion, it seems like it can read anything. So that's pretty awesome. Yes, in fact,
another video that I saw recently, I became aware for the first time that LumaFusion can actually import and use properly even footage shot with a GH5 or a GH5S that's shot in 10-bit. I didn't think that was possible yet on iOS, and apparently it's not officially supported by the operating system, but it is supported by LumaFusion, and I actually saw someone editing with that footage, so that was amazing for me to see. So it's interesting to see how each program has its strengths and its weaknesses. So far, we've talked about some things that apparently are in LumaFusion, but are apparently not, at least initially, in Project Rush. But let's talk about some of the unique things that Project Rush has.
Yes.
For example, Project Rush is completely cross-platform.
Yeah.
Whereas LumaFusion, although it has an XML output, that's not quite the same thing as being cross-platform as the app is concerned, right?
Right, yes. So I know that LumaFusion is not available for the Android. It's strictly iOS. Yeah, sometimes I wish I could bring all of that onto, like, use their same tool, not an XML output, but their same tool on the desktop and go back and forth between the two. So you aren't able to do that, but you can do that. Project Rush. So that's really, really exciting.
Yes. In a prior incarnation of LumaFusion, there was a desktop version for Windows, but it's no longer available. And I don't think it even works with it anymore. It was when it had a different one of its prior names. I'm not going to try to remember all the prior names now, but it had several prior names. So that's one thing that Project Rush has is it's multi-platform, including iOS, Android, Windows, and Mac. And that's amazing.
Yeah, that is amazing. Absolutely, yeah.
And another thing that I see that it has that it's very interesting is the motion graphics. Did you see that?
I did. I think that is the one I'm most excited about because having to edit my footage on my phone, I've been looking for an app that is robust enough that will allow me to create some more complex animations. And right now, the only way to do that is to use After Effects. And so if I can do that on this app, and if I can even import in some templates that were made in After Effects, and apply those, that will just be...
Yes, that seems great to me. And from what I understand, there are going to be some templates included with Project Rush, some templates that were created with After Effects, and that with those templates, you can simply change the text, and it works with that animation, and that other people will be able to create other animations in After Effects that will be compatible through the libraries, the shared libraries.
Yeah.
Is that your understanding too?
That is, yes, that is my understanding as well. And I think this is going to be one of the features that will really separate the editing on this app versus all the other ones.
Yes. Now, let's talk about editing on a tablet and editing on a phone, because you have a lot of experience with that. And all of the editing that I do on, well, I do it on a laptop, but most of the time I do it with a large monitor connected to it. So I would like to know your experience. How long of a project do you feel comfortable editing on your phone or a tablet?
That is a great question. So I think the longest I've created is in the 7-minute range. So I think anything longer than that, you're going to have a hard time because you know, managing a long timeline like that on such a small interface can get pretty hard. So I usually, on my phone, if it's something that's 3 minutes or less, 4 minutes, I will edit on my phone, no problem. But if I know it's going to be longer, and if I'm importing in a lot of media assets, like photos, different clips, and a lot of music, then I usually go to my iPad and start editing there.
Yes, but with the iPad, what would you say is the longest?
The longest, yeah, it would be the 7 minutes, I would say.
Even on the iPad?
Yeah.
So you wouldn't do a half hour or an hour on your iPad Pro?
I haven't tried. So that's all I can say. So far, the videos that I've made have not been anything longer than 15 minutes. But I can certainly see myself doing something around 10 minutes. And if it's not too complex of a video, then I don't see a problem. It's when it becomes super complex that I would probably, to make life easier on myself, take it to the desktop.
Now, when you and I met at NAB in Las Vegas at the National Association of Broadcasters, for the listeners who are not familiar with NAB, it's a yearly, well, at least in Las Vegas, it's a yearly, and now there's another one in New York, which I have not attended. We talked a little bit about the possibility of connecting a tablet like an iPad to an external monitor while you are editing. In fact, that's a feature that's being added to LumaFusion in a non-mirror mode, because it could always have been done in a mirror mode. And of course, when it's not in a mirror mode, you're basically seeing the program output on the external monitor. And if you're doing mirroring, then you see everything in the same place. Have you tried that since we talked at NEB?
No, I haven't tried that. I haven't been able to connect it in that way. No, I have not.
Okay, perhaps you don't have the adapter to go to HDMI from your iPad Pro. I don't know if that's the issue. But can you imagine what it would be like? Do you think that that would make it more comfortable to do longer projects if you were, let's say, touching the iPad on your desk and looking up on a larger screen?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all just really about screen real estate. It's not necessarily that you have more features. It's just the real estate that you have to work with. That would definitely make it a whole lot easier.
And do you think that it would make sense, let's say in the mirroring mode, let's set aside for a minute the special mode that's coming in LumaFusion, because the mirror mode could be used with practically any editing app, as far as I know. So you would perhaps be glancing down for a moment to see where your fingers are going to be touching, and then glancing back up again. Is that the way you visualize that you would be doing it, at least until you get some muscle memory where your fingers remember the spots?
Yeah, that's definitely how I envision using it. Exactly.
Okay. I personally, although I do edit video occasionally, I edit audio only much more frequently than when I edit video. And I imagine the same thing, but I haven't yet tried it. Although I plan to very soon with a 10.5-inch iPad Pro. Is that the size of your iPad Pro?
Yeah, it's the 10.5-inch. And I didn't realize I would be doing a lot of editing on my iPad. Had I known, I would have probably gone with a bigger one. But I do. I mean, 10.5 is fine. Yeah, it's a good size.
Yes. I saw a video of a person who actually returned the larger one because he found it to be too big to handle it
in
his hands. And he decided to return it and get the 10.5. And he recommended that anybody's considering it to go to the Apple store and hold the larger one, which I think is 12 point something, for 15 minutes and see if you can even continue to hold it for that long. Not even actually editing, just holding it, because there's a saying in English about the grass is always greener on the other side of the street. And
that's
sometimes
true.
You cross over, you want to go back.
Right. I mean, I have to say, because it is a smaller iPad, it fits in everything. I always take it with me wherever I am. So I do a lot of commuting into San Francisco on the ferry. So I'm usually editing on my iPad, you know, as I commute, and when I'm on the train, you know, it's certainly much more portable.
Yes. And everything is relative. You're saying that it's small, but it's actually larger than the 9.7 and larger than the iPad mini. So everything is relative.
Right. It is true. But I wouldn't mind having more screen. But then again, the portability. So it's kind of like, which one do you want, right?
I guess like it's having a sports car and a sedan and a limousine, and each one fits different purposes, right? In different situations.
Right. So you're saying I should get both.
Yes. And maybe a 9.7 and a mini also. Who knows?
There you go.
Although perhaps the mini is too close to the size of your phone now, right?
That's true. Yes.
One of the things that you and I have discussed in the past, and I would like to bring it up now, is the question of the reflections. I am extremely sensitive to reflections, and whenever it's possible, I like to get a pure matte screen. In fact, in my desktop computer is a pure matte, and in my MacBook Air, I actually had it transplanted by a place in California called Tech Restore, which at that time was offering the service of swapping it. I understand that since we had our first conversation, you added a matte or anti-glare to your iPad. Is that true?
That is true, but for a completely different reason. So I am not as sensitive to reflection as you are, but there was one thing you mentioned about it that made me buy it. And it's that when you use the Apple Pencil on the iPad, it makes it feel much more like you're writing on paper. So that's mostly why I got it. And if that's absolutely true, I love writing on my iPad now with the screen on it. But as a side benefit, it has cut down the reflection.
Okay, well, I like it for both reasons, although I'm not sure if I will actually ever use an Apple Pencil or not. But I like it because I love true matte. And I know that none of those screen protectors is as good as a true matte, but the more recent ones come much closer than ever before. Now, I'm curious to know what brand you purchased, because I have one that's on the way to me that I'm going to be reviewing, and I'm curious to know what brand you got of that matte screen protector.
It was one of the ones you recommended, one in particular, and I'm sorry I don't remember. You might remember because
okay.
It was
I think it probably might have been one that's spelled I-C-A-R-E-Z, iCarez,
yes.
Or something like that.
Yes,
I don't know how they pronounce it. And that's the brand of the protector that I use on my Android phone. And at that time, it was the best one I ever found. And it's still the best one that I've actually used personally so far. But recently, I found out about one that's particularly made for iPads. They don't make it for phones, at least not yet. I hope they do. But the name of it is called Paper-like, and they call it Paper-like because they want it to feel like paper when you're drawing.
Oh,
and it's made in Germany, and I've been in conversations with the creator of the company, whose name is pronounced as Jan, although it's spelled J-A-N, and any of our listeners who want to see Paper-like, it's at paperlike.com, and they are in Germany. And their screen protector is much more expensive than any of the other ones that I have seen so far, but it's the only one that's specifically targeted for this, for people who want to use the Apple Pencil and make it seem more like paper. And I have seen some reviews of other people who say that it makes it seem much smoother even than another brand that he tried for his iPad or iPad Pro.
Really? Oh.
So I'm anxious to try it, and perhaps you will also.
And, I think I will. Yeah.
It's called Paper-like, PaperLike.
BeyondPodcasting.com.
Beyond Podcasting listener. We love technology. We love to talk about equipment, software, and techniques. But we should also be sure to have proper health coverage. That's why I want to talk to you about my favorite health plan, which I've been using for over 2 years. In my opinion, it's the best plan for anyone who lives in the United States or Puerto Rico. My plan costs a fraction of the Obamacare price, and I love it for many reasons. For more information, visit health.beyondpodcasting.com. Despite a popular misunderstanding, the fine for not having health coverage in the United States continues until 2019, and they'll charge you for every month you're without coverage. Visit health.beyondpodcasting.com. Now, back to the show.
We are talking about all of these things, and I'm excited about all of them. And fortunately, at least in the case of these apps that we're talking about, LumaFusion and Filmic Pro and Movie Pro, they're all what I consider to be very inexpensive apps, especially because my experience buying apps has been with desktop computers like the Mac, where an app can cost hundreds of dollars, whereas on the iPad, even the most expensive app costs perhaps 90% less. And of course, they do it that way because they hope that they will get perhaps 100 times more sales, so they will have a similar profit by having a much lower unit price. So even if you end up, and of course, Project Rush has not yet announced its pricing, they have insinuated that if you are already Creative Cloud subscriber, that it might be included, but they haven't said it directly. And they also said that it will be available standalone. And I think you have a Creative Cloud yearly subscription. So you will probably, if their insinuation is correct, you will probably get it for free. And in fact, I think you were considering signing up for the beta. I don't know if you signed up for the beta.
Yes, I did sign up for the beta. So I'm hoping I'm going to be able to try it out and then put together a little tutorial for it, that'd be awesome.
If they, well, they did imply that it will be available separately. In other words, for people who do not have a Creative Cloud. So it will be interesting to see what they charge for it as a standalone, which is the one, because I do not have a Creative Cloud. I edit my audio, and I even though I know that Adobe Audition is very powerful for storytellers, I prefer Hindenburg Journalist Pro, and that's what I use for editing audio, especially long-form audio that's multi-track. That is my preferred audio editor at the present time. I know that there are features in Adobe Audition, but it's a question of what overrides what feature. And at another point, we can talk about why I like Hindenburg Journalist Pro, although I have published many, many articles about it. So our listeners who are curious can certainly look for Hindenburg Journalist Pro in ProVideoCoalition.com and find it. So from the perspective of a person who does not have a Creative Cloud account, I imagine that they will probably offer either a very, very low subscription price or perhaps a flat price.
Yeah.
The way they do with their Premiere Elements app, which is under $100 by itself, or under $150 if people want it together with Photoshop Elements. So those are the only Adobe products that I know about that are still available at a fixed price, not as a subscription. So I get the feeling maybe they'll sell it for under $100 if it's a flat fee, perhaps, or perhaps they will have a subscription that will maybe be $5 or $10 a month or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. I definitely don't see this being more than $100 if it's a standalone. I'm compared to the competition that's out there, it wouldn't make sense to pay that much. But I can certainly see them doing a subscription basis, such as KineMaster is another editing app. And I think they have a $5 a month subscription.
Right. And as far as I know, and you can confirm this because you're actually a subscriber of Creative Cloud or CC, I believe that they quote it in a monthly amount, but you have to commit to a year. Is that correct?
You know, at this point, I have been part of Creative Cloud for years. I don't even know, but that sounds like that could be true.
I have heard that from other people, but I'm not currently anyway a subscriber of Creative Cloud. So perhaps they might do it $5 or $10, but you might have to commit to
commit
a year.
For a year. Yeah.
So that would be interesting to see what they do. And it will also be interesting if, in order to get people interested in it, perhaps they will have an initial trial or something like that.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I'm guessing a lot of people will want to try it out. And so now that we talk about it, I think then that would make sense for a subscription, obviously. But I think that would be great because not everyone knows what they're going to do with an app and how good it's going to be and how powerful it's going to be compared to the apps that are out there.
BeyondPodcasting.com.
Traditionally, if we wanted to do professional editing, we had to do it on our desktop or our laptop computer. And it seems like the apps that we have been discussing have been pushing the limit about what can be done on mobile devices. When I say mobile devices, I'm talking about mobile phones and tablets. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree. I think more and more, and I don't see why not. Our phones, our devices are absolutely capable of processing video and being able to edit them on the devices. So why not? And then, you know, we can do it on the go. A lot of people are travelers and making these videos and you know, no one wants to wait until they get home and onto their laptop. You want to just do it right there on the spot. And so I think it's great. And I'm really excited that more and more apps are allowing you to do much more robust video creation with just your devices.
And earlier we talked about connecting a larger monitor to have more real estate. Do you think that that makes sense with a phone, or do you think it makes more sense with a tablet, or both?
I think both. Like, I don't see why not. I think, in fact, now that I think about it, the reason why I go from phone to iPad is the real estate. Now, if I can go phone to external monitor.
Now, I get the impression, and I know that you have a lot more experience than I do, but I get the impression that when you're editing, because when you do that with either one, with a tablet or with a phone, I think it's going to be setting the resolution based on the smaller of the devices.
Yeah.
So I think that when you're doing editing, I think perhaps more tracks will be visible simultaneously if the actual smaller device has more vertical space.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I haven't connected to a monitor. But yeah, I would imagine that more space, then you'd be able to see more tracks. Absolutely.
Well, if we discard the external monitor for a moment, if you're editing with LumaFusion on your phone versus on your iPad, do you have more tracks on the iPad than you do on the phone?
Oh, no. You don't. You have the same amount.
Do you know if there's a maximum of number of tracks?
For LumaFusion, and I think LumaFusion is the one that has the most. It's three tracks of audio and three tracks of video. I hear that Project Rush allows you to have four tracks.
Okay, so that means that with LumaFusion, there could be a total of six if you had three audio tracks
right.
and three video tracks.
Yes.
So there's enough vertical space when you have your phone in a horizontal mode, you have enough space to have six tracks.
Six tracks also. Yeah, and you know, on your phone, you can zoom in and out. You can zoom all the way out to see all of the tracks if you want to, or you can just zoom in.
Oh, some of them slide down and off screen?
They can, yeah. Depending on how far you're zoomed into your timeline, you can zoom out all the way to see all six tracks, or you can zoom in and then you're scrolling up and down to see the rest of it.
So if you wanted to be able to have access to all six, does it force you to slide up and down, or is there enough vertical space to do it without zooming in?
Yeah, there's enough. You can configure your layout many different ways. So that's what's great about LumaFusion. You can say which panels you want open. And if you want to maximize for timeline editing, you can just show the timeline and then be able to see more tracks. So yeah.
Okay. So if that's the case, I'm imagining what it would be like. In other words, if what you had your phone connected to a large monitor, like the one that I have in front mm-hmm. of me right now is a 27-inch matte monitor.
It
seems like if it's going to mirror it, we put aside the new option that's coming, then that means that the main difference between having it on an iPad of whatever size versus having it on your phone wouldn't be the limitation of the number of tracks, but it would be perhaps the space that your fingers move to go from one track to another.
That's what I was going to say. It all comes down to your fingers and being able to select and maneuver the things that are on the screen. So yes, you might have a larger monitor and you might be able to see it bigger, but your touch area on your phone remains just as small.
Exactly. So you would have to be much more precise with your pointing when it's on a phone than on a tablet.
Yeah, that's when the pencil would come in handy if you're on the tablet.
But within the tablet, I guess they would be larger. So what they call fat fingers would be less of an issue than on the phone.
Right.
Correct. The fat fingers is more of an issue on the phone than in the tablet, even if we didn't have the Apple Pencil.
I know. I mean, I can't wait till the phone is compatible with the Apple Pencil. That'd be great.
Okay, now I'm going to throw in a curve that perhaps you haven't thought about before, but I only yesterday became that it was available only through Jailbreak, but I just want to know your opinion of it.
Okay.
And that is the capability of using either a trackpad or a mouse with an iOS device when it's jailbroken. Because sometimes things, when they're jailbroken, Apple eventually gives in and decides to make them a standard feature.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you can imagine what that would be like and if you think that it would be a good thing or a bad thing. I think it would be a good thing to have the option, but I don't know what you think about it. And I know that you have used desktop software, so you know what it's like to use a trackpad or a trackball or a mouse.
Yeah. I mean, I think right now what I would ask for is the pencil. Not sure if I would really use my mouse with it.
Well, the thing is, if you're using the pencil, you would have to be looking down at the tablet to see where you're pointing the pencil. Whereas if you were using a trackpad, you would see the cursor on the mirrored screen, so you wouldn't have to be looking down.
Yeah,
I'm just playing devil's advocate.
No, I know. But so I'm a user of the Wacom tablet, so I'm pretty practiced with having my eyes on the screen and then my pencil, like not looking where I'm writing.
So it's not a Cintiq. It's not the one that has the built-in screen, correct?
Right.
It's just a straight Wacom.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so you're practiced with that and that's fine with you.
Yeah, that's fine with
me. So in that case, basically the external monitor would be the monitor and the iPad would be the pointing device and the brain of everything that you're
doing.
Okay. Yeah. Well, this is a very, very interesting conversation that we're having. And I was curious to know if it was capable of happening. So I searched for it and I found people who had jailbroken their iPads and shown how they were using an external. They were using the Apple one, the Apple Magic Trackpad with their iPad. I guess if you are adept at using the pencil, then it doesn't make any sense to you. I understand. And I really appreciate your opinion because I have not done it either way so far. So that's why I was so curious to get your opinion.
Yeah. No, I mean, I know a lot of people like their mouse and like to see that mouse on the screen. So I think the more options, the better.
Yes. Talking about the two apps again, LumaFusion was one of the apps that added the multiple frame rates at my request a couple of years ago, and I'm so glad that they did.
Nice.
And at the beginning, they did it only as far as the non-integer ones. The non-integer ones include 23.976, 29.97, and 59.94, which are still extremely important for broadcast, or if you want to go to a DVD, extremely important to have the non-integer ones. They're not an issue for the web, and they are not an issue for DCI. In other words, when you're going to create a digital film that's going to be played in a digital theater, because in that case, it absolutely must be exact 24, not 23.976. Right. So there are cases where you need each one. At the beginning, LumaFusion only added the non-integer ones with the final export. So when you were creating a project, it had to be just the closest integer. But now they are adding, in an upcoming update that they announced at NAB, the non-integer ones. And nice. At the press conference of Project Rush, I asked about frame rates in general and also the non-integer ones. And they actually said absolutely yes, even though it wasn't part of their presentation. And then they gave me a screenshot, which I included in my article. It's not yet clear to me whether it's only in the final export or if it's actually in the project, but at least having it in the final export is great. And I'm so glad that they took that into account and they were proud of it. And they said, yes, we wanted to be totally compliant with everything that we do with Premiere Pro. And they have the technology of Premiere Pro and After Effects built into this more simplified UI. And I know that you are a UI expert. So
yes.
I love your opinion about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great. I think they should make it compatible. And again, you know, I just like for me, I like the apps are simple and easy to use, but if somebody wants to do more with it, certainly give them the opportunity to do much more advanced things with your app, such as, you know, saving at different frame rates or, you know, even your audio. So yeah, I think it's great. I mean, I hope it doesn't overcomplicate the interface, but Adobe's mostly good at that.
No, in fact, it wasn't even visible. And that's why I had to ask the question. And then they showed me where they clicked to get that option. So doesn't clutter at
all. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's great because myself being an advanced user, I'm fine with having to dig things up. And then once I know where it is, I know where it is and it's not an issue. I think you want to keep your interface clean for those that are just starting to learn. You don't want to overwhelm them. And then once they do get to that advanced level, then they'll look for it and then eventually figure it out. But I think initially, a clean interface is great.
Yes. And Thielo, when you shoot with your iPhone or your iPad, do you use the iographer or do you use the Padcaster or do you just use the bare phone? What do you use or the bare iPad?
I use right now, I'm using a lot of the Joby products. They came out with this mobile rig, which is really awesome. It holds your phone and a bunch of other things like your lights and mics. So I use that to hold my...
So it has shoe mounts?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's the most important thing. It has multiple shoe mounts.
Cold shoe.
Cold shoe.
Yes, I can't stand it when people do reviews and they call it a hot shoe when it's really a cold shoe They're two different things.
Right, so exactly.
I'm
you and I know.
Yes, you and I know. For the benefit of the listeners, if it's a hot shoe, it means that it actually has an electrical contact and communication, contact either to power something or to communicate. But the ones on these, what do you call them? I think you called it a rig. These rigs,
yes.
Whether it's from iographer or from the Padcaster, or what's the brand that you mentioned?
Joby, and I also use Bscript.
Yes. To my knowledge, all of those have cold shoes, which means that it's a physical place to mount something, but it's not any electrical connection.
Correct. Exactly.
Okay. I wasn't familiar with Joby. How is that spelled?
J-O-B-Y.
Okay.
They're the ones,
from
I'm
what
sure
country?
You've seen them. They're based here in the United States, I believe. Yeah.
Are they the people who make the spider tripod or something like
the
that?
The Gorilla Pod. Yeah, exactly.
They're the
makers of
yes.
the Gorilla Pod.
It sounded familiar. Okay. The Gorilla Podcat, not the spider podcat. Tripod.
Yeah.
So, okay, I know which company you're talking about now. Okay, that's great to know. I didn't realize that they were making rigs or devices to hold phones with accessories. So that's great to know.
Yeah, I think so far it's the mobile rig is the one that they came out with. They don't have full on rigs such as the Bscript, for example. I don't know if you're familiar with the Bscript, but Joby does make more the tripods, but they make it compatible with their holders, which can have attachments to their cold shoe mounts.
Okay. Well, what do you see as the future of mobile production and editing on tablets and phones?
I think it's just going to go even further. Right now, the biggest problem is the audio. So the video capture is great. I mean, we can capture 4K on these devices. But when it comes to audio, it's terrible. And you have to do all sorts of configurations to use available mics in the market. So I think going forward, more and more mics are going to be made specific to our devices. So I'm really excited about that. And I'm pretty sure the cameras or the lenses available on our devices are always going to get much, it's going to get much better. And then now with Adobe Project Rush, I mean, there are going to be some really, really great apps out there where you can pretty much do everything on your device.
Yes. Regarding what you said about the audio, I want to clarify for you and for our listeners. I have reviewed dozens of interfaces, devices that connect to mobile devices, whether they're phones or tablets. In the case of Apple, they connect nowadays to the Lightning port. And in the case of Android, it connects via USB or USB-C. And I have also reviewed probably already dozens of microphones that connect directly digitally to the mobile device. And I recently published an article about the challenge when you want to connect more than one. If you want to connect a single one, then it's very, very clean to do it with just directly with the Lightning port in the case of iOS devices. The problem comes in when you want to do multiple. When you want to do multiple, it's not even possible right now with iOS. Yeah. So you have to use an interface or a mixer that later connects to the Lightning port. And then that solves the other problem that I cover in this article. And that is, because even though there are apps now that for Mac and Windows that allow you to connect multiple USB audio devices like the microphone that you're using today,
yeah,
the challenge comes in with the monitoring. And I don't know today how you connected your isolating headphones. I don't know if you connected them directly to the Blue microphone or to the Mac. Do you know which way you connect? Okay, you connected it to the Mac, which means that you're hearing me, but you're not hearing yourself. If you connected it to the Blue microphone, you would be able to hear yourself, which has advantages and disadvantages. It can be a disadvantage if you're not used to hearing yourself, but it does have the advantage of knowing if you're popping or something like that, you would know immediately without me telling you or something like that. The issue is if you were there with multiple people and they were all wearing headphones, you would have difficulty hearing the other people if they were all connected to the Mac, because your Mac is not set up right now anyway to hear yourself. And even if you were to set it up that way, then you would hear yourself with a little bit of delay. So to have multiple people with multiple microphones, it's much easier if all of the microphones are analog and then they all go either to an interface or a mixer where you can be monitoring from that device. In my opinion, based on the observation about the monitoring, it's much simpler, or I would say where the digital microphones thrive. When I say digital microphones, I'm talking about one that has a digital output directly. I don't mean that the Element is digital, because it's not in any of them. They're all analog in the Element, but then the output is digital. Then that thrives when it's a single microphone. That's really where it makes most sense. And I don't know if in your productions, whether you need to use multiple microphones or not. I guess maybe it depends on the particular production.
Yeah, it does. Most of the time I don't. And other times, the few times that I have needed more, it was just for a two-person interview. And usually I use a Y-splitter for that to happen.
Yes, there are some microphones that are set up that way from the factory. For instance, a couple of the ones from IK Multimedia are actually designed to be looped, and then they connect via analog to the phone, unless you have the, for instance, in the case of the iPhone 7, 8, and 10, it comes with an adapter to allow you to plug in something analog. So that has both pros and cons. When you do a Y,
yeah,
all of the microphones come in a single track, and there's only one volume control or level control for all of them. So the only way that you can balance the levels of all of them is sometimes like moving the lavalier a little bit higher or lower on the person's shirt so that you get a balanced level between all of them. Whether some of the other alternatives that exist allow you to have each microphone recorded on a separate track, and that way you have a different adjustment level for each individual mic. And also, it gives you more control in editing, because you can actually equalize each channel separately post if you need to. And then a third option, which is more expensive but much more appropriate if either you don't have time to edit or if you're actually broadcasting live, and that is to use an automatic mixer. So you connect each microphone to an individual input of the auto mixer, and then the auto mixer is automatically much faster than a human being could. It's actually attenuating or shutting off the microphone of the person who is not speaking. And then in a question of a nanosecond, it's turning it back on again. So that is the ideal solution for either live or what used to be called live on tape. And I guess now we would say live on SSD. That rides everything. Because, you know, some things are truly live and some things are live to drive, and there's no time for post-production, or there's very little time for post-production. So you want everything to be as perfect as possible. And that's the audio side. And of course, the video side or the visual side is, if you have all the time in the world, then you want to record in, what's the word that you use for it when it's raw? I forget the term that you used. When you're in Filmic Pro and you put it in that mode so you have more latitude when you're grading. I forget.
I think I mentioned log.
Exactly, log.
Log mode?
You shoot log when you're going to have time to do grading.
Right.
And when you're shooting, like when you're broadcasting live, you definitely don't put the camera in log because, you know, people will
see it
in a weird way. So it's there are situations for each, and it's good for us as producers to know the right way to do it in each situation. So if we're doing something live, we do not use log. We don't try to record every microphone on a different track. In that case, it makes sense to do the baked-in way. The baked-in way is not to do log, just to set the exposure and the color as it should be for live, because no one is going to be able to change it later.
Right, right.
And to use, if we have the budget, to use an auto mixer and have it just ride the levels perfectly and either attenuate or completely gate, depending on the situation. And I have reviewed already a couple of those auto mixers, and I have one pending to review. I love them in that situation, and I know that there are situations for everything. You probably wouldn't do that for a commercial spot or a theatrical film. With a theatrical film, you want to have all the control and spend all the time that you need to do grading and to equalize each track separately. But then on the other hand, if you're doing it live or almost live, you want it to have the baked-in look the best you can and ride the levels the best you can. Do you have any comments about that or questions about how that works?
No, I think I think you definitely know more about audio than I do. So I definitely trust your opinion and all of that.
Well, I think you can probably understand it on a practical level too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you know what multi-track means, and
you know
that when you have each audio track separately, you can do whatever you want. You can either mute it or you can equalize it differently. So, but that's not appropriate for live or live to drive,
which
I like. I like how
live
that sounds
to drive.
Because it rhymes.
Yay, that's
it
a good rhymes. One. There you go.
it sounds even better than live to tape.
Absolutely. Did you just come up with that?
No. I actually came up with it about a year ago.
That's a good one.
I like the way it sounds. The problem is, if you Google it, you find all these articles about people who love to drive a car. Because in depending on the context, live
it becomes
to drive
live to mean, live to drive.
Exactly.
BeyondPodcasting.com.
This is Beyond Podcasting, and in Beyond Podcasting, we normally talk more about audio. I am going to mention the devices that I am using, and Thielo can do the same. I am using a microphone from Rode that I'm going to be publishing a review very soon. It's called the M5, and it's actually a hybrid because it's the M5 microphone being used with the enormous windscreen and pop filter from Shure, which is called the A81WS, and I'm connected through a Tascam interface model US-1X2, which is one of two that Tascam has sent me to review. The other one is the US-2X2. And the reason that I connected the 1X2 this time, which is the one that only has one microphone input, is because sometimes when you use certain web services, sometimes it can't listen to both channels. So by connecting one that only has one channel, it sort of forces it to be compatible with any web service. And we are today using cleanfeed.net to connect and to record this conversation. So I wanted to be sure that there would be no issues where it would only be perhaps grabbing one of the two channels or something like that. And Thielo, why don't you tell us what microphone you are using today?
Yeah, I'm using the Blue Yeti mic, though it's connected via USB. And I love it. It works well.
And we are both configured at 48 kilohertz, which since we are both doing it on the Mac, we do it in the audio MIDI configuration or something like that in English. What is it called in yours? Because you have your system in English, so you can tell us what it's called in English.
Yeah, it's just called audio MIDI. That's all it is.
Also. Oh, okay. Audio MIDI. Okay. So it has a slightly different name in the Castilian version of the operating system. And speaking of languages, I know that you speak the most popular language from the Philippines, which is Tagalog. And this is something that comes up because people argue, because as you know, the last few operating systems from Apple have been named by places in California. And I think you live in California, right?
I do, yes.
So some people from California who only speak English have a tendency to pronounce some of those places in a very Anglo way. And I would like to know if you have an opinion about these things. And I think it goes back to El Capitan, which was a couple of operating systems back. Since
yes.
I do speak Castilian, I have a tendency to pronounce it as El Capitan. And I imagine, I don't know, but I imagine that in Tagalog, that it would be pronounced in a similar way.
Yeah, yes, very much so. Yeah.
So you would also say El Capitan, correct?
Yeah, normally I would. That is how I would say it. Yes.
Exactly.
That's so not there what are they some say people, here.
Some people call it Capitan with a short A. And then there are other places. And the most recent one is causing a lot of controversy right now about how people pronounce it. So I don't know if you recall any of the other names and your natural way of pronouncing them, but I'm just curious if you have any opinions about those things.
You know, living in California, you kind of just say things the way people are saying it, and most of the time it's mispronounced, so I'm guilty. I was calling it El Capitan just because that's kind of what everybody's saying. I mean, it's similar to, so I used to live in Australia, and a lot of the places there we would pronounce obviously with an Australian accent. So I grew up pronouncing places like Melbourne, which is what people say here. And I would say Melbourne because that's how we said it there. And same with other places. So
interesting.
Yeah.
It causes controversy when it's the same name and it's written the same way. And it does not cause any controversy when the place has an official translation in another language or something like that. For instance, most, if not all, of the European countries have a completely different name in each language. So people don't argue about which is the right way to pronounce
to
it.
To say,
Germany in Castilian is called Alemania, and in German it's called Deutschland. So people don't argue about the right way to pronounce it. But perhaps a particular city which doesn't have a translation like what we would say in English, Berlin. I don't even know how it would be pronounced in German. In Castilian, it would be pronounced Berlin. So it's people have these arguments when there is no official different way of writing it and saying it. A lot of these places in California, they have names. Some of them are indigenous names and some of them are Castilian names. And for the listeners who don't know, Castilian is the world's most widely used Spanish language. So a city like Los Angeles or San Antonio or San Francisco, they are not translated. If they were, they would be the angels and they would be Saint Anthony and things like that. And since no one has translated them, it seems like it's obvious how it's intended to be pronounced unless someone decides to translate them to the angels and Saint Anthony and other places there. So I was curious to get your opinion since you do speak another language and it shares a lot of the phonetics with Castilian. So I appreciate your opinion there.
No, so I mean, a lot of the names here are totally butchered. And being in California, a lot of the city names, for example, Alameda, which is the city I live in, it's pronounced Alameda when it should be Alameda. So I think we just kind of are just used to the butchering of the names that everything is mispronounced, that it's just hard to just correct people and say it right. And in fact, people look at you weird if you do say it the correct way, and then you have to explain yourself why you're saying it that way.
BeyondPodcasting.com.
It's been great to have Cielo de la Paz from The Storiographist on Beyond Podcasting, and I hope you return very soon, Cielo. You've been a great guest here.
No, thank you for having me. It's been great chatting with you.
You have a very, very good perspective since you have a lot of experience producing and editing with mobile devices.
Yeah, I mean, I love speaking about it. It's one of the things I love doing.
So you can say your URL so all of our listeners can visit you.
You can go to thestoriographist.com. So it's thestoriographist.
Some of the manufacturers mentioned on the BeyondPodcasting.com show have contacted Alan Tepper and or Technotour LLC to carry out consulting and or translations, localizations or transcreations. Many of the manufacturers mentioned have sent Alan Tepper review units. Some links to third parties mentioned in the show may indirectly benefit Technotour LLC via affiliate programs. Alan Tepper's opinions are his own.